理课堂听 class.com
Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Elizabeth, Queen of England, she ruled through 4 decades of glory and danger. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Angela. I'm here to lead you in this history lesson. This is the third day that we're looking at the life of Queen Elizabeth I in England. In the studio with me are 3 other panelists. Let's hear from Bill first. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Angela, and I'm happy to be back here for this third day of this article.
We are getting to know Queen Elizabeth quite well, aren't we?
Well, it's a fascinating history.
That it is indeed. And with us to be our expert on the panel is Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Angela. Hi, students.
And the reason I say that you are the expert is because you are a British citizen.
That's right. So I learnt all about Elizabeth I and her family. Long time ago, though.
And you visited some of the historical sites that are mentioned in our article.
That's right, I did.
Okay, and then the third person completing our panel is Ethan.
Hi, Angela. It's always great to be back. And as we've been talking about this, I've just been thoroughly enjoying myself because I love history. And so learning about kings and queens and all the political marriages and that, it just really fascinates me how all of this happened.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one point that we keep in mind, Ethan, is that the world as it is today is in a large part a result of the decisions that these people made. So it's a very important study for all of us.
Well, definitely. And we learned about the religious happenings at this time. The Roman Catholic Church was being the largest and only church at the time, mm-hmm. and then how it divided and the Protestant Church broke off from it.
Mm-hmm. So for our listeners who may be joining us today and missed the previous 2 lessons, let's give a bit of background. Melissa, what period of time are we talking about?
We're talking about the 16th century in England.
Okay, so that was about, 400 or 500 years ago, right?
Yes, this is the 1530s, 1540s, 50s, 60s, so in the 1500s.
Okay, now some people may say, wow, what does 500 years ago, the things that happened then, have to do with life today?
Well, I just had a thought, Angela, that this is England breaking away, one, from the Catholic Church, and mm-hmm. two, just forming as their country, and later England would become the world power for several hundred years, mm-hmm. and we can actually trace this back to a woman, Elizabeth I.
Yes, and you know, also what occurred to me is that this is that period of time after the Americas have been discovered, but really before a lot of the colonization has occurred. So what is happening in England and in the rest of Europe is a part of our American background as well.
As we'll see, also, it affects Europe greatly, too, because, again, they're breaking away from the church. And in today's reading, we'll see some of the other things tied in with Spain and some of the other countries.
Yes.
This is also a time, and we don't learn about it in this article, but afterwards, Elizabeth is the one that promotes a lot of the culture and the literature that was happening at that time. So famous writers like Shakespeare, we all know who Shakespeare is. Well, he lived at this time, and it was because of her that he was able to write so many plays and everything. So that's why this time is so crucial and so important to world history.
I think this article focuses on the religious turmoil because that was, I believe, the defining events of this era. And yet through it all, we have this queen who is on the throne for 40 years plus.
Well, yes, and we talked about that Mary and Henry were zealots, and they had major major religious actions that happened during their rule. And so mm-hmm. Elizabeth came along, and she sought to be a stabilizer, someone who would bring stability. And that was really what England needed at the time. It helped, mm-hmm. as Melissa said, the arts and also the economy to become a power.
But she was not without her enemies. In fact, as we ended the lesson last time, we learned that her cousin, Mary Queen of Scots, schemed throughout her lifetime and wanting to become the Catholic Queen of England because Elizabeth was a Protestant and yet not a zealot. Protestant. What does that word zealot mean?
Well, a zealot is someone who has very strong beliefs and they're going to try and impose them upon you. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that, yes, she has many threats and we've talked about them and we'll see more here today. But you mentioned, Angela, she ruled for 40 years. That's an amazing amount of time, especially during that period in history when most people didn't even live 40 years.
That's true. And I believe in our first day we talked about Lady Jane Grey, who was on the throne. How long?
9 days, a queen of 9 days.
Yes, queen of 9 days, and Elizabeth's younger brother Edward reigned 5 years.
5-6 years, and Mary the First, too, only a very few years.
Yes. So here is Elizabeth on the throne 40 years, not without her threats, and we're going to learn about a very serious threat right now as we begin today's first reading. The Glorious Victory. An ominous threat arose from abroad. Elizabeth knew that Philip II of Spain intended to attack England, so she turned England's minuscule navy into a fearsome fighting force, equipping it with a lighter and faster fleet than Spain's. On July 19, 1588, the Spanish Armada was finally sighted. In the ensuing battle, England lost 100 men, while Spain lost 20,000. It was a humiliating defeat for Spain. This victory of Protestant over Catholic forces helped ease England's religious turmoil. The victory, people said, was by the hand of God. However, Elizabeth's joy in victory was short-lived when soon after her beloved friend, Robert Dudley, died. Afterwards, she appeared old and tired. Her glorious military victory could not begin to compensate for her terrible personal loss. Well, there might have been other international incidents, as we might say today, but this one proved to be a defining point in Elizabeth's and in the Spanish king's reigns. So what are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the threat from Spain of Philip II, and he wanted England. He wanted to take over England.
Now, there's interesting background to the relationship between Philip II of Spain and the English queens. So what is that background?
Well, originally he married Mary the First, who was queen just after Edward and before Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And then when Mary died, he sought after to marry Elizabeth as well. And so it seems apparent that he really wanted to have his eyes on the English throne. He really wanted to be in power in England as well as Spain.
Right. And a point to remember within the context of our article here is that Philip II of Spain was a Catholic. Okay, so that's all a part of the conflict. He then, since he could not gain England through marriage, now he has put together a fleet of ships. Elizabeth recognizes the threat, so it says here that she turned England's minuscule navy into a fearsome fighting force. Now, what is a minuscule anything?
Well, a minuscule anything is anything that is extremely small. So at this time, Spain had a very large navy. They were probably the largest navy in the world, very, mm-hmm. very powerful, and everyone was afraid of them. But Elizabeth looked at it and she said, well, let's see what we can do with our smaller navy that will help to at least protect us against this.
That's right, a fearsome fighting force, equipping it with lighter and faster ships than Spain's. And these ships are called a fleet.
I believe England really didn't even have a navy before this. What the navy consisted of for England mm-hmm. at that time is they actually would hire out pirate ships to do their business. So they really didn't have a navy before this time.
Mm-hmm. They had merchant ships because there were merchants sailing to different ports. But you're right.
But as far as conducting warfare, they had no such navy set up.
And so I actually have studied this a little bit, and I found it quite interesting. Most of this minuscule navy actually turned out to be small boats, converted fishing boats maybe, and that. But the main thing was that they were very small and very quick, whereas the Spanish boats were very large, and they may have had a lot of guns and power, but they couldn't move as well, and so the English ships were actually able to outmaneuver them.
So, Melissa, this Spanish fleet has a special name that we all know from our study of history, right?
It's called an armada, and that's just the Spanish name for the word fleet.
Okay, and so those of us studying this event in English history, call it, we know this as the Spanish Armada. The date is July 19th, 1588. Elizabeth at this time is 55 years old. So, Bill, as you say, she has lived a long life for that period.
Well, by this time, she's already been on the throne for 30 years. And I just find it interesting that Philip II would attack her. I think it's like he proposed marriage to her. Well, if you don't marry me, then I'm going to attack.
Well, that's what he did. And there was a battle. It's called here the ensuing battle. And what does that word mean?
Well, ensuing means happening or following something else. And so it was directly following.
The battle that England lost 100 men, but the Spanish, what was their loss?
They lost 20,000 men. So that's an incredible ratio, 100 versus 20,000.
I think there's no doubt who won this battle.
Definitely not. And as I was talking about the faster ships, what actually happened in this battle is these smaller boats could move in between the bigger Spanish ones, and they would set fire to the bigger boats. Mm-hmm. But they were also fast enough that they could avoid the gunshots and the attacks, and they were not in danger.
So they were smaller targets, and they were small targets that could move quickly, and so they were able to escape the damage or the cannon fire that could come from these Spanish ships.
So in line 26, it says, it was a humiliating defeat for Spain.
Right. I would think it was quite humiliating. But the people saw this more in terms of a religious conflict. It's like Protestants versus Catholics at this point.
Well, and as we talked about in the past, Philip II was a Catholic and probably a very, very strong one. And Elizabeth, although she didn't press her views onto anyone, she was a Protestant. So English was under Protestant rule. So it was kind of a battle between two different religious factions.
You know, it's interesting. This is kind of an aside, but Ireland at this time was also under English rule completely. But this Protestant-Catholic division was evident even at this time. Actually, this is the time when it's beginning, the beginning of the turmoil that still exists today. I mean, when you think about it, right, Bill?
Well, it's hard to believe it, but yes, it exists today in Ireland, which is strongly majority Catholic, and then also in Northern Ireland, which is still experiencing the fighting and between the Protestants and Catholics. So this is something that's going on for 500 years.
Well, I know, and that's the irony of it. You'd think that after 500 years, they would have been able to settle these differences and learn to live with each other.
I know. It is hard to believe.
Well, fortunately, Queen Elizabeth I was able to bring a measure of stability into her land, and this victory was one that helped to ease the religious turmoil within England itself, because many people said the victory was the hand of God, the will of God. And so they accepted that Elizabeth, as their sovereign, was there, placed there under the will of God, and that if it's her desire that the country be Protestant, then so be it.
Well, this goes back to what I was talking about, that shift in power in Europe from the Catholic Church. And Spain was very powerful, maybe the most powerful country in Europe at that time. And here they were defeated by the English, which pretty much set off the next several hundred years in history of England then becoming the world's dominant power.
And that's why I say it affects our American history as well, because as you say, Spain was the dominant power. They are the ones who were colonizing large parts of the New World, as they called it at that time. But as we realize, now England is able because of their, maybe because they did build a navy of sorts, but because of their prestige, they are now set and equipped to go into this new world, and that affects our history for those of us from North America. Well, on a personal level, though, Elizabeth was not able to enjoy the fruits of her victory very long.
No, this is kind of a rather sad thing I found. This is a wondrous battle that she has fought, and she's come out the victor, and so it should be something she takes great joy in. But at the same time, she has a great personal tragedy happen, and that is that Robert Dudley, who we talked about actually in the first program as being a childhood friend and actually an advisor to her, has died.
Oh, we did talk in the first day of her close relationship with Robert Dudley, and what was the significant comment she had made to him?
That she would never marry.
Right. So from what she had seen of her father going through his five wives and the sixth one outliving him, she said, marriage is not for me.
But I do believe that if she had, he would have been the one. But unfortunately, you know, fate didn't go that way. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that's also why she was so sad.
Mm-hmm. She had been pressed by her advisors to make a match with different ones from Sweden, from Germany, from England, from France, and from Spain.
She needed to marry someone who was of royalty, I think, of royal blood, and I don't think Robert Dudley was. He was just a commoner, but her best friend.
Yes. So he died, and it devastated her. She just lost her enthusiasm for life at this point. She was 55 years old, so Bill, she had outlived most of her contemporaries, and it says that she appeared old and tired. This glorious military victory could not begin to compensate.
I actually had underlined compensate there in line 37, Angela. Compensate means to offset. Or maybe we might use compensate as in a way of pay for, but compensate here means to maybe balance out. And this, even though she had this great victory, it wasn't enough to overcome her personal loss.
She's 55 years old, and ultimately she'll be on the throne of England for more than 40 years. But we still have 15 more years of this lady's life to talk about. So let's move on now to page 27 and read the last part of today's lesson. Elizabeth's final days. It was, in fact, a time of overwhelming loss. Almost all her counselors were dead. Deeply in debt, she was forced to sell off Tudor family treasures. There were physical losses, too. She had few teeth left, and her eyesight and memory were failing. However, this woman, whose life had been defined by her ferocious will to survive, was still fighting. She became terribly ill, yet she refused to go to her deathbed. Instead, she sat on a pile of cushions, not eating. The 69-year-old queen soon became unable to speak. She died on March 24, 1603, and was buried in Westminster Abbey. Her life had been one of overwhelming glory, and yet it had also been filled with hardship and loneliness. Perhaps she best summed it up in her last speech when she said, "To be a king and wear a crown is more glorious to them that see it than it is pleasant to them that bear it." Well, it is the understood inevitability that we all die. And this is true of kings and queens as well as the lowest commoner. Elizabeth knew that her days would come to an end. Yet, it's really sad, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is. And I look at this, she is living and she has had a very rich life, but also a very, very hard life. Mm-hmm. All the trouble in her childhood with the many marriages of her father, and then the political unrest under her brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And so I can see that it would be a very, very tough to live during this time, especially to have the responsibility of being in charge of this country.
And not married. You know, as a married woman myself, I think that this would be an awesome responsibility for her to carry on her own. Now, who could she really open herself to and share her heart with? Well, she had this childhood friend, Robert Dudley. He passed away, and it really seems that this is what devastated her.
Well, not only Dudley's death, but also in line two there, it says almost all of her counselors were dead. So mm-hmm. Here was this group of people that was around her that she felt comfortable and trusting, and then they were all dying off too. So I'm sure she probably felt very alone.
Right. And then it says too that England was in debt. You know, war is a very expensive endeavor. She had to somehow come up with the money to pay for developing a navy, no matter what size it was. She was actually selling off some of the Tudor family treasures. Okay, so we are coming down to the end of the Tudor family line. What plans do you think she had made for the succession?
Well, I was looking at this, and it looks to me that Elizabeth was a very, very noble person. She wanted to put the people and the welfare of her country before herself and her family. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason that we didn't see her get married to try and produce an heir was that there would be added turmoil and added pressures that would come with that, whereas this way she could totally focus on serving England, but it also cost her a great, great deal.
Well, let's remember, too, in our last lesson, we talked about the threat of Mary, Queen of Scots, who was a cousin to Queen Elizabeth I. She was actually the next in line to the English throne. But because of the conspiracy and the schemes that Mary, Queen of Scots, had been involved with, she was executed in 1587. Now, this was just the year before the Spanish Armada attacked, and Robert Dudley died.
Well, and I think this is also a point that we can look at. If you read that sidebar that we have down on the bottom, it talks about that Elizabeth didn't really want to order this execution, but she was kind of forced into this situation. And mm-hmm. So I think that was also an example of something that was another weight that was put on her shoulders right at this very crucial and difficult time for her.
Right. And with Mary executed, then her son, James, which was he? The James VI became King of Scotland. Now, he is the next of kin to Queen Elizabeth I. But he is not a Tudor. This is the Stuart family line,
right?
That's right.
It's a different family completely.
Right. But upon Elizabeth's death, he would be the one to inherit the English throne.
That's right. And I think they're related through, it goes back through Elizabeth's father.
Mm-hmm.
It was her father's sister's line that's mm-hmm. coming down. So they're distantly related.
That's right. You know, I can't help but think about the English people. You know, how did they feel about having this king come over from Scotland to take over as their sovereign?
Well, it's almost like picking a name out of the hat, it seems like to me. I wonder, too, as far as James, Melissa, do you know anything about his religious orientation?
Do you know?
Yes, he's a Protestant. And that is an interesting thing because within the context of this time, the Catholic-Protestant turmoil seemed to be the deciding factor.
That's interesting, particularly since his mother was Catholic. Mm-hmm. And wanted to rule as a Catholic. We talk about loss and Elizabeth losing Robert Dudley. And as Ethan mentioned, she really didn't want to kill Mary, Queen of Scots, but she had to strengthen her government. And the last couple sentences in that box, A Queen's Conspiracy, we see that Elizabeth was personally fond of Mary. Mm-hmm. And then she wept profusely when she learned that Mary was dead. So here was somebody that, oddly, she had to execute, but was extremely sad about it.
Mm-hmm.
So now in light of knowing all of this, knowing James's that he was a Protestant, maybe because Elizabeth was fond of Mary, Elizabeth was also fond of James, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
So
possibly.
I think she was rest assured knowing that, James is my next in line, but he's okay.
Well, let's just consider this. The King James Version of the English Bible was commissioned by this James.
So this was the king.
This is the James, the King James, who commissioned the Bible in 1611 that many of us Protestants used up until about 30, 40 years ago.
And some people still use nowadays.
Oh, sure. It's written in the old English, and in many ways it kind of harkens back to the Shakespearean English, but yeah, it's considered the classic literature for the Bible.
Well, the significance of that is most Bibles at that time were written in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very difficult book and really wasn't available to the masses for understanding. The Bible at that time was just used by the Catholic Church, and they interpreted things and translated it.
So you can see the importance then of ensuring that a Protestant came to the throne of England. And with James I, he was firmly grounded as a Protestant, even to the point of making sure that the Bible was translated and made available to the masses in English. And this, again, is an act that has influenced all the rest of us through the centuries. Well, let's go on and quickly finish this lesson. We learned that in Elizabeth's final days, her health broke, her eyesight was poor, her teeth, I mean, she didn't have a dentist to repair her teeth, and her memory was failing, and yet she had a ferocious will to survive, this same ferocious will that had defined her life.
Well, yes, and we see that she lived much longer than any of her contemporaries, and this was not a very common thing. And I think this is part of also what helped to bring the stability to England, is that she was able to stay in power and to hold down the fort, we might say, or to be the person who was consistent for her people.
At 69 years old, she died and was buried in Westminster Abbey. Now, what is Westminster Abbey?
Westminster Abbey, it's a historic church in London where British rulers are traditionally crowned and actually where many rulers and famous people are buried.
So it's right next to the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben, which I think everyone knows. It's just across the street.
So when you take me to the Tower of London to see the crown jewels, Melissa, would you take me to Westminster Abbey?
Of course. It's just down the road, kind of.
Great.
I think Melissa can actually tell you that there's many permanent residents there, aren't there?
That's right. In Westminster Abbey?
In Westminster
Abbey. Oh, that's right. Many famous royals are buried there. You can go in for a very, very small fee. You just pay a few pence and you go in and you can just visit all these different tombs and learn about the history.
Oh, well, that's the way to learn history, isn't it? Well, Elizabeth's life had been one of overwhelming glory, filled also with hardship and loneliness, but we say that she summed it up in these words. That is, she expressed briefly the important points. And what did she say?
Well, she says, to be a king and wear a crown is more glorious to them that see it than it is pleasant for them that bear it.
We have to end with that. I think that's an apt ending. So we invite you to come back and join us again here on Advanced. Until then, this is Angela,
Ethan,
Melissa,
and Bill
saying goodbye.
Goodbye.